The Hess Committee is convened, and this is, let the record show that the meeting is starting at 3:38. Let the record reflect that Representative Keller, Representative Faircloth, Representative Gardner, Representative Seaton, Representative Roses, I know that they were up in the other room with us, so I know they'll be here. So, and myself, Wilson. So we do have a quorum to conduct business. And I'd like to recognize that we do have Debbie Tillinghast, who is our House Recording Secretary, Sammy Kanine, who is our LIO monitor, and of course my committee aide, Becky Rooney. And before we start, if you have cell phones on, please turn them off, because even if you just put them on vibrate, they mess up our recording system. So if you could do that, we would sure appreciate it. We're going to try to get through three bills today. SCR 17, Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Month, House Bill 274, University Report on Teacher Training, and House Bill 50, Child Placement Compact. So first we're going to hear Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 17, and we will have Version C before us. And would the sponsor please come forward and explain the resolution? And Senator McGuire is unable to be here, so Trevor Fulton is going to present the bill. So, Trevor, could you come forward? I just should say the resolution.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator Liesl McGuire. Senator McGuire sends her apologies that she wasn't able to be here to present the resolution in person, but there was a scheduling conflict. So thank you. This resolution really speaks for itself. It's not new territory. I think everybody here has seen it before. The legislature has passed it several times in the past, including just last year. So I'm probably not going to tell you a whole lot that you haven't already heard before about making March Brain Injury Awareness Month, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to say it. This bill is about raising awareness, and in the spirit of raising that awareness, I'm going to go over a few points about brain injury and why we need to raise that awareness. Alaska is the number one state per capita for brain injuries in the nation, and traumatic brain injuries is one of the leading causes of death for young people in the state. The statistics show that too. Alaska has seven times the national average number of traumatic brain injuries per capita, and if you go out into the bush communities, that number actually skyrockets to 14 times. So it's definitely a issue that's at the heart of Alaskans' concerns. Over 800 TBRs are reported annually in Alaska, and an estimated 12,000 Alaskans have suffered a traumatic brain injury. These injuries are often life-altering and consequently place a tremendous strain on victims and their families. Many victims often live with permanent disabilities, and the tragedy of TBI is exacerbated by the fact that most TBIs are preventable. Another reason we need to raise awareness about it is the more people are aware of the tragic consequences of traumatic brain injury, the more we would hope they were able to prevent them. The Brain Injury Association of America recognizes March of each year as Brain Injury Awareness Month, and this resolution would comport with national recognition by making March 2008 Brain Injury Awareness Month here in Alaska. Now, I know I said I wouldn't be telling you a whole lot you haven't heard before, but there is one addition we made to the resolution this year, and that is essentially to bring attention to the fact that TBIs are on the rise in the state of Alaska, and that's primarily because we have returning military personnel who have served overseas and been in combat and sustained traumatic brain injuries. And as they return home, the incidence of TBIs in Alaska is on the rise. So what all these things add up to is a bunch of reasons in a long list of good reasons why we need to raise awareness about the silent epidemic. And they do call it a silent epidemic because a lot of people who have TBIs don't even necessarily know exactly what their condition is. So it's important that we get the word out there. It's important that we raise the awareness, and it's important that we continue to strive to improve treatment in the state of Alaska. And I would hope that this bill or this resolution does all that. And with that, I would like to go ahead and open it up for questions.
I wanted to make a comment, Trevor, that I wanted to ask our senator when he was here the other day about that, because of the fact that he's on the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee in Washington, and I wasn't able to ask him that on the floor, but I saw him later that evening, and I asked him, you know, is there going to be more work done, especially here in Alaska, since we have so many more veterans returning, and that's happening to a lot of them. And he assured me that they are working on it right now, and they're working on getting more help for our returning veterans. And I was real pleased to hear that, because we had some testify, one family member testify in front of our committee, and it's pretty sad. And this fella came back pretty normal, and then it progressed downhill from there after he got back home. So. Do any of the members have any questions at all? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed in the title, and we just have Brain Injury Awareness Month, and yet throughout most of the whereases and all and resolves, we're talking about traumatic brain injury. Is there a reason why that the name has been changed, and what implications does that have for a publication of Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Month when we're not having that in the title of our resolution?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. It's my understanding that the main difference between a brain injury and traumatic brain injury is that, you know, all traumatic brain injuries are brain injuries, of course. When you say just brain injuries, I do believe you're including, and I forget the terminology, I apologize for that. And we do have the executive director of the Alaska Brain Injury Network online, and she can probably answer this question better than I. I'll take a swing at it, though. Just calling it Brain Injury Awareness Month also includes other sorts of brain injuries, not necessarily sustained through trauma. That would include alcohol abuse or substance abuse, other sort of...
Strokes,
thank you, exactly. And I don't think we completely want to exclude, you know, that whole portion of what we call brain injuries. The focus, we're coming at it from the perspective of traumatic brain injuries specifically, but we wouldn't want to exclude everybody else who has sustained those other types of brain injuries. And it is National Brain Injury Month, and we're shooting to comport with that. I hope that answers your question.
It, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I guess it does. It just, you know, all our whereases basically are not talking about stroke or not talking about fetal alcohol syndrome or any other alcohol involvement. It seems like, although you may be getting very inclusive, it also seems that you're not getting the emphasis that you are trying to put on through all the whereases. But I'll accept that, Madam Chair.
Okay. And I think it covers it a little bit in the last whereas in the first page.
Second.
No, on the first page, it's known as the disability in the disability community as the nation's silent epidemic. You know, it's kind of silent because it happens to people, but, you know, like when it's not trauma, it is kind of silent because of just the name of the animal, I guess. But is there anything that you'd like to add to this? You know, are you Representative Seaton?
No, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify, because I think in the past, I think we have had a similar resolution in past years, but I believe it was Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Month, and I noticed the change here to being something different, and I don't see it. You know, that last whereas is actually whereas the vest, that traumatic brain injury is what that's addressing. So I'm just trying to get clarification.
Seeing no other questions, I think we will move to testimony. And we do have someone from Kenai, Richard Warrington.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, if you would state your affiliation and your name and give us your testimony.
Hello, representatives. My name is Richard Warrington. I was appointed on the ambassador program from the Brain Injury Association of America, and I'm a board member of the Alaska Brain Injury Network. And the first thing is I wanted to point out about the conflict with just the name of Brain Injury Awareness Month compared to Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Month. That's like October, where it's Cancer Month, but there's all sorts of different cancers. Cancer episodes, breast cancer, all the different cancers. Well, there's all sorts of different brain injury, but we're going about, that's why we're trying to name just a month as Brain Injury Awareness and point out traumatic brain injury underneath it. I'm a survivor of a traumatic brain injury that occurred 31 years ago, and I'm still disabled. Brain injury is a hidden disability. I really encourage you to pass it because it occurs every 21 seconds. With this bill passed, it might help get the awareness around and get the injury cut back from occurring that often or that fast. Does anybody have any questions?
I don't see any questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. T. Frank Box from Anchorage.
Hi, I'm Frank Box. I work at Access Alaska. I'm a two-time brain tumor survivor. That's one of the other brain injuries. But anyway, I survived that. Two surgeries, a bunch of radiation, a year of chemotherapy. Access Alaska hired me out of the head injury support group, and I help people. I've been working there 5.5 years. And we do a lot of good work and peer support. And the rehab is largely the same. And I was reading, Joe Hodges gave me some figures. About 2% of the constituents in your districts have suffered a TBI based on national prevalence rates. And Alaska rates are higher. Access to providers that understand TBI is essential for recovery. And every dollar invested in brain injury rehab to support saves $35 in future medical costs. So building awareness in the rural areas who are asking for a lot more information regarding TBI, where rates are 14 times the national average, would be a good investment. And it's not like it's going to cost anything to make this awareness month. You can just tie it onto the shirt tail or the apron strings of the national movement. So it seems like a really good idea. Do you have any questions for me?
Don't see any questions. Thank you very much. Jill Hodges from Anchorage.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. My name is Jill Hodges. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Brain Injury Network, and it was very nice joining the committee 2 weeks ago to present with Mrs. Stephanie Tanner as well. Thank you very much to everyone in the room. I am continually amazed by the efforts and the time that your staff and you put into listening to our needs and helping find solutions. So thank you very much for that. I did want to point out the fact that, you know, the Alaska Brain Injury Network keeps coming back. And our organization really is dedicated to listening to the needs of Alaskans who've been affected by traumatic brain injury and turning those needs into solutions. The energy that it takes to live with a TBI or to support somebody with a TBI, which you learned through Mrs. Tanner, is very consuming. And to have an organization in the state that can take on that role of developing solutions is really positive for Alaska. And I thank the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority for our funding to serve that role. One solution, and that you have on your plate today, is SCR 17, Brain Injury Awareness Month. And I also wanted to share that at the federal level, when the federal government passed this bill, they had the same debate. And I think it was Representative Steaton, is that correct, that
yes.
brought up the issue of brain injury versus TBI. And they first passed a few bills that were solely traumatic brain injury. And then the Brain Injury Association of America took a stance that brain injury encompasses all acquired brain injuries. And here in Alaska, if you you know, listen to Frank Box, who just spoke, that he's a tumor survivor, the needs of some of the TBI and those with stroke or tumor or substance abuse related brain injury, they flock together. And the programs in place for somebody with a substance abuse problem that potentially could turn into a brain injury are already in place. Services for somebody with solely a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, who does not have a physical disability, they aren't in place here in Alaska. And so it's bringing awareness that we can serve these two populations together. Let's bring the TBI population in so that they can get the same supports that people with stroke and tumor survivors and thus the treatment that they go through as well. So with that said, I just really wanted to thank you for listening to the Alaska Brain Injury Network. We're in contact with hundreds of TBI survivors and family members, and they really want to be here to provide comment, but their lives definitely are focused on their daily living and getting through the day and staying productive citizens. And with that, I did want to announce that at the federal level, the Center for Disease Control is rolling out a new campaign in March, and it's going to be Help Seniors Live Better, Longer, Prevent Brain Injury. And nationally, those over the age of 75 have the highest prevalence rates of brain injury. Here in Alaska, the CDC numbers show the same, but our incident rates really show that our 15 and 24 age group have high rates as well.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? What is the age in Alaska?
Over the age of 75 have one of the highest rates of brain injury if you look at the prevalence numbers. If you look at the incident rates here in Alaska, which are those actually happening through the hospital trauma registry, ages 15 to 24. And we're continually working with the Commission on Aging, Denise Daniello, to work with her to include some awareness around TBI among the elder population.
Okay, thank you very much, Jill. And I don't see any questions, so we have one more. Jeff Irwin from here in Juneau.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, my name is Jeff Irwin. I work at Southeast Alaska Independent Living, and I would like to extend my support for considering March as Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Month. I feel it is very important to better inform the public about this disability. I hope that by doing this, more interest and funding will be invested towards this issue. Alaska should really be addressing this issue due to the high rates of injuries, especially in the rural communities. We need to provide more information to the public, better diagnostic tools to healthcare providers, and more support for those who have suffered traumatic brain injuries. A traumatic brain injury is called an invisible disability due to the fact it is oftentimes not readily apparent. Let's make this disability more visible to Alaskans by declaring March Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Month. Thank you for your time and consideration. Are there any questions?
Don't see any questions, Jeff, and thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Is there anyone else online? I don't have any names, but just want to make sure. Would you like to come forward and testify?
My name is Anthony Syverson.
Wait.
I work on the on Bernie C. Crabber, longliner. I worked on 11 different ships from the South Pacific, from Washington up. Plus, I used to roof houses, but. About 5 years ago, I had a traumatic brain injury where I fell off of an unseaworthy part of the vessel and hit my head, and I almost lost my arm. I started having seizures. I passed out and fell and almost lost my arm and almost had to amputate my arm. I fell in the bushes and had a seizure. My brain hemorrhaged, swelled up. I got cellulosis of the brain and almost died from the injury. Trying to make it law right now. that I'm to receive compensation through the insurance company. I support the TBI. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming and testifying. Is there anyone else? Seeing none, we're going to close testimony. And what is the wishes of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I have a quick question. Does this relate to what we're talking about now? This is something else. Okay. Never mind, Madam Chair.
Do I hear a motion? Representative Gardner?
Sure. Madam Chair, I'd be like to move Senate Concurrent Resolution number 12.
That's 17.
Number 17. With any individual recommendations, and I don't see a fiscal note. I assume there's a zero fiscal note?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Hearing no objection, so moved. And for all of you that are online and testified, we really appreciate it. And it's on its way to make March Brain Injury Awareness Month. Thank you. Okay, let's go to the next. Next, we're going to have House Bill 274, and that is the University Report for Teachers Training and Retention. And Representative Hawker, this is your bill, so if you can tell us what it's about.
And thank you again, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here for your records. I am Representative Mike Hawker. I represent District 32. Madam Chair, it's a pleasure. I'm beginning to almost feel like a member of your committee this year. And unlike our previous discussions, I believe this one I can make mercifully short for you all. And this is another one of the recommendations that was brought forward by the consensus of the Joint Legislative Education Funding Task Force that we conducted this summer. And again, for anyone watching this today, two of your members, Representative Roses and Representative Seaton, served on that task force. I know you were not on the task force, but very active in monitoring and participating, as did most of the legislature. So one of the recommendations out of the task force, and that is this one, came out of some discussion that was held amongst various members that they felt there hadn't been enough coordination or communication discussion between the legislature and the university on what the university is doing to prepare and teachers to enter the field of teaching and for the state to retain those teachers. As the task force's process was that when a member had a proposal they wanted to have included in the final report and the task force was in a consensus of agreement, we included it. This particular bill would ask the university to prepare an annual report to the legislature entitled Alaska's University for Alaska Schools and describe the efforts of the university to attract, train, and retain qualified public school teachers. The report needed to include an outline of the university's past, present, and current plans to close the gap between known teacher employment vacancies in the state and the number of state residents who complete teacher training. Certainly seemed like a laudable goal to me as sitting on that task force. The members concurred. That's what the bill would do, ask the university to do this each year. I would acknowledge and ask the committee here to give a very serious consideration to the what may be very compelling testimony that will be provided today by the university, that perhaps they are already accomplishing what this goal was. I would commend this particular bill to the will of this committee, but I would sincerely ask you to take very much to heart the testimony that the university will bring forward that we did not have available to us when we concluded the activities of the task force this summer. So that, Madam Chair, I would be happy to submit to your queries.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Question to the sponsor is, given that the university's position is they're providing all this information, is it your desire to get it collated in a specific form for this task force, or would you be content with just reviewing it?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, The motivating legislator behind this particular piece of legislation was, I think, and I'm looking at my colleagues here, I believe it was something that Senator Wilken was really championing as the idea. And he seemed, and I, so I'm kind of having to interpret what I think he was after, and he was after a tool to have a, you know, to create a talking point, a specific discussion document to be able to foster the communications between the legislature and the university on this subject. So I hope I've answered your question.
Madam Chair, so the information that the university already has could be used, combined into one single document, and they're not asking for any new research or anything like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, that is my understanding of the intent of this request.
Thank you.
Representative Keller?
No.
Oh, Representative Seat, and then.
Thank you. Looking at the fiscal note on here, I mean, it's a zero fiscal note. Basically, in the analysis, they're looking at this bill saying it's not going to cost us the thing because we're already doing it, or even a compilation of data doesn't seem to be. It seems to me from the fiscal note that they're saying that that the bill isn't going to require them to do anything. Is that your interpretation of what that what the bill would require of them?
You know what? Why don't we have the university come up here and we can ask them?
Madam Chair, I was going to suggest the same thing.
Is that Pat Pitney?
Yes.
Okay, come on up, Pat.
For the record, I'm Pat Pitney. I'm with the University Budget and Planning Office. We kind of are the source for a lot of the basic data beyond the budgets, as well as looking out. We try very much to link our planning with our budget requests. In terms of the intent, the Senate has changed this bill just slightly to make it more explicit. What they would like to see is that that it's a dialogue between the board members and the legislature, and it's so that it says that the board will come and speak to the legislature on this topic in the first month of the session each year. The zero fiscal note is that we do several reports. One that speaks most directly to this is called the Alaska Teacher Supply and Demand Report. We do not do that report every year, but we do it about every 2 or 3 years. You know, it's the type of thing that you need a couple of years to go by before you see how your progress is. So we don't feel that it requires additional money, and it's also our goal to address the highest demand worker shortages in the state. And so by nature, that's what we do. So again, I think we have plenty of information. I think this document, overview document, was that provided? Okay, we will provide it shortly, but there was a four-page overview document of the activities that we do. I'll just go quickly through that. We've got three schools of education, one here in Juneau, one in Anchorage, and one in Fairbanks, sorry. They each have programs. They have separate niches. They have separate markets they work with. They have programs that range from baccalaureate to master's degree secondary programs. Beyond that, we have the Institute for Social and Economic Research. They have done the primary reports on the Alaska teacher supply and demand, and it looks at of the teachers, of the students who graduate qualified to become teachers, how many becomes teachers, how many go into the workforce, and how many stay in the workforce, you know, 3-5 years down the line. And it does show that the university provides about 30% of the teachers that the state needs. The largest gaps are in secondary STEM disciplines, science, technology, and math, and special education. Turnover is much more prevalent in rural schools than in urban schools. In fact, there's sometimes two newly credentialed teachers coming into the market in being hired in the Fairbanks School District, and it might be as little as 10 newly credentialed teachers being hired in Anchorage. There's a lot of churn of existing teachers or teachers that were credentialed and came from the rural schools into Anchorage or Fairbanks, but new credentials. Where new credentialed teachers are really in demand are the rural schools. It also is a place where the turnover is fastest. And there's many, many factors beyond just the training, but the fact is we're producing about 30%. The university feels like a request from this committee for a report on whatever timely basis would suffice rather than a law, but we don't mind the law because what it does is provides the opportunity for the dialogue about what is happening at the university to reach these goals. If you've looked, I'm on the budget track, you know, recently, and you know, in fiscal year 08, we did, although we weren't provided with funding that covered all of our fixed costs, we also did reallocations. One of those reallocations was putting a special ed teacher faculty in here in Juneau because it was an area, but that came through reallocation. And fiscal year 07, we also made some teacher education investments. So I think having the opportunity to talk about that is important. Most of the dialogue we have is all around the budget. For a committee like this to talk about programs, I think would be very valuable. Another program that's out there is called the Future Teachers of Alaska. It's a program that we're doing in conjunction with school districts, the Department of Education, and the university. And this is getting career awareness at the younger junior high, late grade school, junior high level, getting them prepared. What will it take to get through an education program? And having that career awareness, that's a great program. Of course, the teacher mentoring program, a strong partner with the Department of Education as well, that works with first and second year teachers. 300 first and second year teachers throughout the state have a master teacher that works with them on a regular basis, traveling out to their site, serving that student, that teacher, to understand what it's like. And you know, sometimes a new teacher is lonely. That particular program has been very successful in raising the retention rates of teachers in the career field. So many, many areas to talk about, and it provides an opportunity. Whether it needs to be legislated, that's strictly up to you, but I think having the formal opportunity, board talk to the legislature would be fantastic. And we had a board member at two of the Senate meetings, Pat Jacobson from Kodiak testified once, and then so did Cynthia Henry, both in agreement that it would be a great opportunity.
Pat, what I'm thinking of is something a little bit different. I'm thinking that maybe it's a possibility that the instructors who are teaching the students, that they need to maybe adjust or maybe even go out. Maybe they need to go out into the bush somewhere and see what it's like out there so that they can come back and say, and prepare, so that they're prepared to handle some of that. Because some of the stuff is not anything they learn in the classroom when they get out there and they go, oh my gosh, I can't do this. And so I think maybe that we need to change a little bit how we prepare the teachers before they get out there. And because most of the new ones, that's where they end up lots of times, is out in a rural area where there's, you know, the once they're out there, then they want to get out of there as quick as they can because they're not totally not prepared. And so my thoughts are that maybe we need to start looking at what the instructors are teaching and maybe filling in some of the cracks that those teachers out there need so that they're prepared a little bit better. Maybe they need to know how to deal with kids that their parents maybe I don't know what kind of situation they'll have, but maybe that the parents they're afraid to come to the school, or they just don't like the school, or whatever. Or I think that maybe they need to be prepared in some of those areas, mm-hmm. so that the teacher knows that some of the problems they're going to have, not just how to teach, but how to deal with some of the problems, and so that they have more confidence when they get thrown into something like this.
There is a program, and it's only for a limited number of students because, as you can imagine, it's a costly program. It's called the Rural Practicum. We made that base investment in, I believe, in 2007. And what it is, it's a program based here in Juneau. But what they do is provide the internships at the rural schools, and it could be anywhere from a 2-week stint to an entire school semester. But what that does is say, is this really what you are ready to do? But that rural practicum gets them there kind of before the end of the training, but gives them that perspective. And I do think that more and more of those things, part of what we want to look at is not just training a bunch of teachers that could pass the credentials. We want to get teachers that are willing to take the jobs that are available. So some of that, you have to do a little bit of both, because some students say, I want a teaching degree, and we've got to accommodate that. But one of our biggest things is, will this person want to take the job that's available? And so we also are trying to really make people aware of what jobs are available. So that rural practicum has been helpful. How broad can you stretch that opportunity is another thing. What we're hearing, and it's more anecdotal, is something we want to look into, that the internship program, where you'd have to take a year off of work, for somebody that's a mid-career person that has to spend a year in the classroom in their internship, it could be up to $20,000 if you're a single college student. But what if you have a family? Sometimes it makes that prohibitive. Some of those kind of how do you do it a little bit differently type approach are things that I think also need to be looked into. And actually, there are several different approaches going on that accommodate that. How do you make it point to those areas that we have the largest shortage?
Of the students that want to be teachers, are any of them taught like how to deal with anger management and that type of thing? I mean, these are things that are real nowadays.
Right. The deans may be on the line. They've been invited, but that would be something that they'd have to talk about the curriculum. I can't imagine that's not in the curriculum, but I don't know.
I have no idea. Representative Roses.
I might be able to address some of those issues. I sat on a group that was operating off of a grant that we had where we were dealing with teacher enhancement throughout the state, and it was made up of individuals from the university, and former Commissioner Shirley Holloway was also a part of that, and we looked at a number of issues that we felt were potential obstacles for the maximum capacity for training of teachers, and out of that came the statewide mentorship program. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had had conversations about it before. We had created a mentorship program in Anchorage, and then that parlayed pretty much into the model that was used for the statewide mentoring program, but it came through that committee, through that group. But there were other things that we saw in the internship. And so the transition between whether becoming a certified teacher in the state of Alaska was going to be a 4-year program or whether it was going to be a 5-year program, and we tried both, and one worked and one didn't work. So then they finally decided they're going to do both. But if you went through the one, you ended up with your master's degree, and part of that was that year-long internship, which, as she's already testified, had built-in obstacles because of the finances that were involved. But it also gave you a rural perspective because you spent, I think it was 6 weeks, if I'm not mistaken, in the rural communities in those school districts, and many of those students who went through that program did take jobs in the rural area. But one of the other obstacles, and I would hope that as we start putting this information together, as we report this, that we include not just the data of how many entered, how many graduated, how many are employed, but what I would really like to see in there is the university identifying what they think are the obstacles to being able to expand the program, because there are many.
Right, and
not the least of which is each campus that has the teacher training program, the courses are not necessarily numbered the same. So if somebody transfers from one program to another, they have to either redo or go an extra year to make up for the classes that didn't transfer. And that is a big issue, and it is very territorial within the university system. They're each trying to protect their areas, but unfortunately, it causes a detriment to the students that are trying to move. Now, this was a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, that I was involved in that group. Maybe that's been fixed since then, but I doubt it.
Surely it has.
The yeah. other piece on there, and then I'll let her address those concerns, but the other piece that was involved in this had a lot to do with there were more people wanting to enter the program to become a teacher than they had capacity for, and it had nothing to do with the education department. It had to do with the specialty areas, like there wasn't enough capacity in the science department for them to get the science courses. There wasn't enough capacity in the math to get the math courses. And then being able to have those different departments at the university cooperate with the education, you know, teacher training program in order to coordinate the coursework. And so there's an awful lot of interaction and interactivity in the university to iron out. And they were working on that when I left that group. So hopefully it's improved, and maybe we can get a report on that.
I'll speak to just a couple of those. I think one of the things the opportunity would of a report like this would provide is to break through some of the things that, well, that was the way it was 5 years ago that you have broken through. And I think the transferability, general ed credits by mandate are transferable across there. But if you start in a baccalaureate program for science and you want to go into a baccalaureate, you know, to be a science teacher, and you're going to switch into being an English teacher, those likely will not change, and actually that problem will never be fixed, because it's not a problem. It's a change in course, you know, the course content is different, and you'll have to take them different. So if you hear of a problem like that from any student, give us a call. Tell us who they are. We will track it down. The transferability issue plagues us as a major negative, and most of the time, it's they want to now become a math major. They took math for poets, and now they have to take calculus. I'm sorry, yeah. Math for poets is not going to transfer. So please tell us who the student is. Tell the student to call us. We will track those down. And if it's non-transferable because of, you know, number changes or, but other than curriculum, major curriculum, not major, reasonable curriculum differences, we will handle it. Guaranteed. That one plagues us everywhere we go. In terms of the obstacles, this is another thing. This issue is a state policy issue. The university is one piece of that puzzle. Having that dialogue with legislature, Department of Ed, Alaska Post-Secondary Ed, you know, other related policy units. I think the Department of Workforce Development, or the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, is also a good partner in this. If we're all focusing on this together, understanding everybody's issues, we can move a long way. Just as an example of obstacles, in Bethel, a TSA agent makes more than a teacher. That's you know. That's dramatic. So,
Representative Farrell.
Madam Chair, I apologize for being a wet blanket right off before I say anything. I am in support of this legislation should it ask for the university to look at what it's doing from that perspective to supplement and produce teachers and retain teachers in Alaska. And I'm also open to a different discussion on a different level about pay grade issues and retirement issues. But what I don't support in this particular piece of legislation, and I only jump to it, and maybe I'm jumping to the wrong conclusion, but because of the fiscal note and the however that Ms. Pitney provided, but prepared by Michelle, however, a joint report to the Department of Education, UAA, ACPE, and school districts may be useful, as well as streamline that information. I think there's two different discussion. One is what we pay people, which you just spoke to in your testimony as to a challenge for retention. But the other question that I thought that this, that HB 274 is discussing is, what is our university doing with the dollars that we invest in the university to meet the needs and the issues of teachers and teacher retention? And so I see this as a very defined report that has great value to understand, and I also see great value in understanding through a joint effort the discussions of why inside of state agencies, inside of school districts, we can't retain, but I see them as two separate issues. So I just would be happy to hear a response to that if I'm all wrong with where that discussion is going, but I just see those as two very distinctive issues and see that this legislation is trying to accomplish the first.
I absolutely agree with the first. It's an opportunity. I think it is a huge state policy issue and would endorse the larger and broader discussion. But in terms of legislation, it's focused on the university. We will work with the other parties in developing that report, but the focus will be on our programs, our investments, and the results of those, understanding that it isn't the whole picture of retention of teachers in Alaska.
Madam Chair.
I'll walk Representative Fairclough.
Oh. You know, I just reviewed the law, and it appears that there's an A missing in the document that's before us, and the reason that that's important is because A is what references B. B starts to reference A, and that somewhere we've just forgotten to insert an A online. I believe that's, when I look at the rest of statutes, that's how it's done. On page 2, line 1, after the word property, before the word the, there should be an A, lowercase a, to reference that paragraph, that paragraph is now becoming A. So
what line are you on?
Page 2, line 1, after the bolded property. It's just, the reason it makes a difference is because when we go change the other that are bolded to the change, it refers to A and there isn't an A.
So, oh, I see. On line 6.
It's no big deal. It's just a paragraph. I don't know if it's important or not, but both, it refers to two different sections. So I looked up the other section, and that has to do with appropriations, appropriations chapter 25, 3725.010, expending balances of one-year appropriations, and it refers back to the 190, which would be a different section. Now it would be 190A. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, duly noted. I kind of just feel that it should be more than it is, and that's why I brought up that I think it has to, this is more than just numbers and throwing numbers around and saying, oh, we're doing already these things. This is getting results in making some changes in the way we teach students to become teachers and what we prepare them for to go out to be teachers. I kind of think that's what legislators want. You know, they want to see, when they say we want to know what you're doing, we mean, what are you doing? I know a lot of these programs indirectly have something, but I think maybe that I know of teachers that have been teachers for 20 years, and they're still using the same lesson plans that they had 20 years ago, and that doesn't get it, you know? And I'm saying in the school system now, not in the university system. But I'm sure it happens in the university system also, you know? And so I guess that as a legislator, that's kind of what I want. I want to see that you guys are reviewing what's being taught and making sure that they're prepared to go out. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. I think that it would be, it can fit in the, there's several accreditation reports, each as mandated by the state school board. These schools of education have to have a particular accreditation And that accreditation lays out curriculum. It lays out follow-up and outcomes assessment for these teachers. And I think that having somebody speak to those accreditation reports and those requirements may help you on the curriculum. That's a very detailed piece. I think the curriculum will drive, will produce the outcome. And if the outcome is a teacher that's a quality teacher who stays and works in Alaska, that's probably the outcome. Measuring it to that, understanding those pieces, I think would be very interesting, and we'd invite people to come and ask those questions to the deans and to the faculty. Certainly not something I would be prepared to speak to, probably not the level of the dialogue if it were a Board of Regents member and legislative dialogue. But certainly we're open to people coming in and joining.
Yeah. And yeah. I guess I'm some states have said that the legislatures have said that if they're going to be teaching teachers, then they need to go out and see what it's like out there, because it's not like it used to be. I guess that's where I'm coming from. And how many of professors or instructors or whatever they are, how many of them have been out of the university classroom in the last 5 years or something like that?
And I think it varies by member, and
yeah, I'm sure
and probably improving, yeah. But varies.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely.
Representative Roses.
Thank you. Not a question. I just wanted to make a comment on the line of conversation that you've started here. The task force started down the path of having some of those conversations early on, and we quickly suspended it, simply because that was not the task that we had at hand that we were charged for by the legislature and what we were supposed to accomplish over the summer. But one of the reasons that, or another recommendation that came out of the committee, was to either reestablish a standing committee on education, or if that didn't happen, at least to make sure that we had committees in both bodies that would take a look at and be able to have this type of substantive conversation about where we're going, rather than every year the only education conversation you had was about money. So the intent of doing the early funding or the forward funding mechanism was so that we could create an opportunity when these committees met to have this type of substantive discussion and to analyze a little bit more clearly where we think we're going and whether or not the money is being used adequately. So that was part of the discussion. This is simply one of the building blocks to eventually get to that house that you're talking about. And so we knew we didn't have the opportunity, the time over the summer to have this type of conversation, but clearly recognized that those were the kinds of conversations that needed to be held. And so this is just one of the pieces to put in place to move to that point.
Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Parker.
Madam Chair, not to interrupt your sequence, but as I was just having quick reflections on the question raised by Representative Fairclough on the sequencing of statutes, that is a sequencing matter that is handled by the reviser when the statute is incorporated into law, and that's why our drafting manual does not include resequencing. Otherwise, every bill we'd have would resequence the entire code while we're looking at the bill. So that one is one duly noted. Sharp eye, but Julie, thank goodness, reminded me that the reviser handles that.
Representative Seaton?
Are we through with public testimony, Madam Chair?
Yes, we are.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I guess I shouldn't say it. Is there we don't have anybody online, right? Okay, there's nobody online, and so we will close testimony. And what is the wishes of the committee?
For committee discussion.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I was also on the task force, and the task force, as Representative Roses and Representative Hawker both alluded, I think was a funding task force. There were a number of issues identified that need to be further investigated, and those included charter schools and homeschooling, and this was another one of those that was brought up. But I really think that this is a subject for overviews and a conversation that needs to be taken up by the Standing Committee on Education, which we have all passed. And, you know, we've got a zero fiscal note on this, so the intention is if this is here, basically not much is going to get done by this legislation. And I hate to put it off and say, okay, now we've done that, so there'll be some report or some group of reports, and it goes away. And I personally would rather make this an issue that we assign to the Standing Committee on Education when it meets, to have that overview with the university and determine and have those policy issues on how teacher education can be more effective and what the legislature and that those committees want to have the university do. So I appreciate the subject very much, but I don't think it is going to get us really the conversation we want to have as much as not doing it and having that an issue for overviews and the conversation between the committee and the university. So, Madam Chair, I'm not going to support this for that reason, not because I don't think it's a very important conversation, but I think the conversation needs to be in much more depth than we're going to have if we just require a report with a zero fiscal note.
I agree. Representative Fairclough.
Madam Chairman, when I went out and asked about the A to Representative Hawker, he pointed out very eloquently that we may want to wait until the Senate version comes over to us, and I don't know if that would encourage the other body to pass the education task force or move it at all, but it certainly would reflect Representative Seaton's need to hold it on this side so that it can become an issue and have the conversation that the House is looking for.
Yeah. Representative Seaton?
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify. I am in no way indicating that I think we should hold a bill for leverage with the other body. I think that this is an important issue, and I don't think that that's what you were implying, but I just wanted to make sure that that isn't my intention here, and I think that this needs to be addressed very detailed by a Standing Committee on Education if that goes forward. So, thank you.
And any other comments?
I have one.
Representative Rose.
Just to that point, in the title it says this is an act relating to a report to the legislature. I highly doubt that they would be coming before the entire body to give the report. My feeling is that if they were reporting to the legislature, it would be to that committee, and it would be up to that committee to then use the information in the way in which it was designed to be used. Now, I may be mistaken, unless I've missed something here, maybe the intent was to present to the entire legislature, but I don't think so. So I think we are accomplishing that, and that was, as I recall, part of the conversation, that if we're going to have a conversation about attracting, retaining, and training of teachers in the state of Alaska, it'd be nice to know where we're starting. So the idea of having the report is, where are we now, where do we need to get, and then start having those conversations of how do we get there. So I believe that was the impetus behind requiring this report, that it not be to the entire legislature, but to that committee.
And I want to make a comment that I think that there are some discussions that should be before the whole body, because there are some legislators that don't understand about social service matters or about education matters, or, you know, everybody kind of floats to the area where they like it or they feel comfortable, and the rest of them kind of don't care about some of it. And I think that many legislators aren't informed and knowledgeable about some of the things that we have to deal with. And so what I'm going to do, if it's not going to be too upsetting with the bill sponsor, I'm going to hold this for the simple reason I don't think this is going to get us where we want to be. And I just don't think that the, well, I just won't make any more comments because I think that right there says it all. We know where we want to go, but we don't know how to get there yet. And this bill, I don't think, is going to get us. So we will wait until the Senate bill comes over. I'll look it over, and maybe we'll bring them both up again at the same time and look at them and see what we want to do. And maybe some of us will come up with some ideas by then. And Representative Seaton, you wanted to say something?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that to fulfill this, we get about, I don't know, probably 50 or 60 reports to the legislature, and it's a pamphlet that comes in and is filed in the filed up with the secretary on the Senate and the clerk on our side, and we may get a copy or we may get an email notice that there is an electronic copy available, and that fulfills the terms. And that's where I'm thinking that we'll get much better action on this if we actually have overviews and have that conversation. So I appreciate it. And I've been having eye contact and basically nonverbal conversations with the sponsor of this bill, just so it's recognized that I believe the sponsor of the bill is in agreement that we all want to get to the same place.
Yeah, and I think so. So we're just going to hang on to the bill for a while. And
and if I might, Madam Chair, I sincerely believe if I was in your seat today, I would make the same decision you're making. But I just offer for the committee's pondering. I sincerely, when I came here today with this bill, I was very ambivalent. I was totally ambivalent about it. It wasn't something that had really been something that it was not my passionate issue on the as the task force worked. And if anything, I was leaning, if I would have just voted cold on this bill, I would have been leaning towards Representative Seaton's conclusion. But I will say, and I mean it sincerely, when I listened to the testimony of Ms. Pitney and the university and the dialogue with Representative Roses, I quite sincerely believe that I was becoming more and more convinced of the appropriateness of doing something like this for the reasons in the dialogue, but I absolutely concur, I share your conclusion that we're not sure what we want to do yet. And to that end, I would just point out procedurally here that this is one of those rare bills, and it's an honest-to-goodness bill, that has a single committee of referral. That would be you folks sitting in judgment here are the only legislators who will hear this and make the determination before it goes to rules in the floor. So, again, I think your erring on the side of caution is not at all an error, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, everyone that came. And Patty, I really appreciate your testimony. And I kind of think that we don't want to waste anybody's time, you know, and we don't want to waste your time gathering some stuff together that is not maybe perhaps going to get us where we want to go. So, yeah.
Dialogue.
Yep.
How do we get from where we are today?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. And now we are going to go to House Bill 50, Child Placement Compact, and that is with Representative Coghill. And you never know what we're going to do with these bills.
I see.
Actually, I don't plan to move your bill today either, you know, because I think there's, I think we'll just barely have time for you to kind of explain it, and so we'll hear the bill quickly, and that'll give us an idea of what it's about, and then we will take it up again. I'm not sure when.
Thursday?
Okay, next Thursday. So, Representative Coghill, if you will proceed, and we will listen. Thanks. And we do have. We have a CS before us, and would someone please move the CS for version E? Representative Roses.
Thank you. I'd like to, as a working draft, move the CS for House Bill 50. That would be version E. That'd be 25 LS0265,
okay.
dated 2/19/08.
And we now have version E before us, and Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I'm going to do is give you a short explanation of why I've got involved in this, why you have a version in front of you, and then some of the details can be answered both by my staff and the Compact Commissioner. I went ahead and introduced this after listening to a presentation at CSG about interstate placement. It seemed like a good idea. And I talked to one of the local judges who has to deal with our present-day interstate compact and some of the failings it had, which actually encouraged me more to bring it forward. But then in reading it last year, I came to the conclusion that we were surrendering way too much sovereignty in order to enter into this compact. One other state had previously introduced this, and it was in an omnibus bill, which they're, I guess, the way I understand it, they're in the process of backtracking. I wrote several letters explaining some of my issues with both those states that had introduced it, the one that had passed it, and all the commissioners of the Interstate Compact Commission and the Council of State Governments who is managing the compact language, expressing my concern with some of the I thought, overreaching language. Come to find out there was other people that also had problems with this particular compact. So the benefit you'll have is listening to one of the commissioners as they debated the compact language, because ours is only either sign-on or not sign-on. You know, we don't really get to change the language. And so you get the benefit of listening to one of the compact commissioners. Some of the problems that we have are, how do you get children who need a placement under our court order in Alaska, say, getting a placement in Oklahoma? Or how do you get a visit in Oklahoma on a child who has a parent in Alaska? And how do you do that timely and those types of things? So that's what a compact is intended to do, give you the rules to make sure that those things work. And I'm going to defer to the commissioner on the details of that, if you don't mind. I think it's time we do it. The one we have in law has old language, and the commissioner will be able to tell you where those languages don't work. It was put in, I think, in, she said 57 yesterday. I have 1960 in my language. I don't know where my study went wrong, but I believe her. So I would encourage you to give it a good hearing. You have to have 35 states introduce and pass this before this compact comes into effect. So because I was very critical of the original compact language, and because the commission actually listened and straightened some of those things out, I felt it would be important as a good faith effort to go ahead and move ahead, talk about the compact. I think it's very, very important that we move forward. It really, truly is an issue where, because of the mobile society that we live in, the amount of military folks and people who are transit in Alaska, we have huge issues with our courts and with our child placement issues, both in adoption and in child need of aid cases. So I think this actually gives us much better rules. It holds us accountable. It holds them accountable. It gives us rules that we can actually fine each other by, which you'll find is different than the new compact of so many years ago. The administration efforts of 1960 were quite different than the administrative laws we need to operate by today. And certainly many of the rules of both adoption and child need of aid, including how we treat parents and grandparents, has changed significantly. So it's time to upgrade the compact. My capable staff here gave me a note. Marsha Pickering is the lady who knows all that you need to know about the compact, because she has been in the nose-to-nose debate within the compact commission on what this language should be and why it should be the way it is. So my little part was writing a letter to all the commissioners and the various different states and the Council of State Government on why I thought it was overstepping. What I didn't know was there was places like the adoption agency, national agency, that's probably in your backup. It's the American Public Human Services Association, I'm sorry, had some trouble with it, and they were actually able to pressure or convince the commission to change some of their law. And so you see, I think, a much better compact before you, and that's why the version E. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to escape the room. I've got people stacked up in my office. And thank you very much for bringing it forward. I will say this. It probably is going to take 2 years before we ever actually enter in this compact. But now that this compact has kind of the green light by a lot of different associations, I think it will probably travel rather quickly throughout the different legislatures. And personally, I hope so with this one. I think it's just a part of upgrading our language so that we deal both accountably with other states, responsibly to children, and hold each other accountable while we do it.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember looking at a compact, and it would have been about 6, 7, 8 years ago. And it was because, as a former foster parent, I had situations where this applied, and it was important to deal with it. But I don't remember. Does anybody remember whether that was an attempt at that time to change it, or was it the existing thing then? I'm just curious.
I looked in the law, Madam Chair. There was an amendment to the section that this compact resides in. It was not a change to the compact articles. And so we might have made some rules that we would operate by in the state. And that was 2003 or four, I think. Mm-hmm. If my recollection, mm-hmm. But as far as replacing the whole compact, I looked, the compact is old.
Yeah. So this okay. is essentially a new compact.
It is.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Representative Colgill, as we go through this, does the sponsor statement and the memorandum of September 14th that we have of 2007, do those address the current version that we have, or are those addressing the previous version?
My sponsor statement and the my sponsor statement does. Now, I'll have to check with my staff on the version C, because she has mine labeled version C.
Version E, it applies to version E.
Okay.
These apply to the current?
It just says C, but she said it means E.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure that I was working on the right things.
All right. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I may have the same question and not have understood the answer, but we have here on your letterhead a memorandum dated September 14th, and on the second page of it, it said it should be noted that the Attorney General's office has advised OCS, yada, yada, not to agree to the compact.
Madam Chair.
That's the older version.
What I'm going to do is have my staff kind of straighten out some of those things, because at the end of the day, I think it's just a matter of paper shuffling, and I really am going to have to go. She knows the answer. I don't. Sorry.
Madam Chair, for the record, Reneva Moss, staff, Representative Coghill. The memorandum, Representative Gardner, through the chair, is for the old version that did have language in it that, quite frankly, said in black and white that regulations adopted by the commission would supersede state law.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the current form of the proposed new compact, Representative Coghill, the sponsor of this bill, is supportive. Do we know yet if the state's attorney general is making a recommendation, a similar recommendation, for OCS and our Commissioner Jackson?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes, the state attorney general was not here today because we didn't think we'd get real legal questions today, but Assistant AG Carla Raymond is the attorney that is dealing with House Bill 50, and she will be testifying.
Thank you.
And I guess I want to follow up with what Representative Gardner said. So we also have something as the September 11th memorandum from Jean Michel. And is that, which version was that?
That would have been the old version.
Okay, version C. Okay. All righty. Any other questions? Seeing no other questions. Is there anything that you kind of want to, we've got about 8 minutes left. And so why don't you, okay, Marcia, why don't you come forward and kind of explain to us exactly what this is kind of going to be doing.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Marcia Pickering. I am considered the Deputy Compact Administrator for the ICPC for the Office of Children's Services. I was appointed to that position 7 years ago. And for the last 4 years, I've been on the executive committee for the National Association of ICPC Administrators. Nice. And for the last year, have been actively involved in this newest version, which died. I mean, the old version died. And so we went back to the table and worked on the newer one. The current compact was written in 1959. The first state this signed on was in 1960. That was New York. But it took 15 years for that compact to be ratified. We didn't have an interstate highway system. We didn't have the computer advancements that we have today. And we didn't have administrative law. So when the new compact, when the old compact was written, each state could send a member representative to come up with the rules of how we were going to do business. And that's what the states had agreed to do. Over time, though, the states started interpreting things a little differently. Times had changed. Our rules were no longer considered having the force of law. So one of the changes with the new compact is the Interstate Commission. The Interstate Commission will be required to operate under administrative rules. They can't just come up as representatives, come up and make up the rules, and everybody's got to abide by them. Okay. There will be a process.
And what do you mean when you say exactly what does that mean?
Administrative rules?
Yeah.
That means that they're going to create them. They're going to have to publish them. There's going to have to be public comment. It used to be just myself and my counterparts would sit and debate about it. But now we have to have public comment, partnerships, stakeholders, everybody's at the table. And even if it's passed, if the majority of legislatures in the nation decide that the rule that has been promulgated is no good, we have an opportunity to overturn it. So it's not a done issue. The new compact is intended to bring uniformity to the process because states have strayed in the way that they interpret the old one. It provides for accountability, continued reciprocity, meaning if Nevada asks us for a home study, we're going to do it. We're not going to charge them for it because 2 months later we might ask Nevada for a home study and they're going to do it for us. It's hard on New Jersey. But for the rest of us, it's not as bad. It's also going to hopefully ensure safe and more timely placements because there's so many delays now, different states requiring different things in documents, that it's just, no. We have to come to a common language and do this right.
I wish the insurance companies would do this.
Okay. It's been endorsed by the executive committees of the National Council on State Human Services, which is APHSA, American Public Human Services Association, who started the rewrite of the new compact. Also the National Association of Public Child Welfare Administrators, the administrators of ICPC, which I'm one, and the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys, who not single-handedly, but put a lot of money in killing the first version. They went to every state that put forth, and they went to every state and testified and said, So that's where that is.
They're part of the team.
Now they're part of the team.
Okay.
Many long teleconferences later to negotiate with them, and it was all based on language. So we came a long way in the last couple of years, especially with them. It provides, highlighting the changes, it now provides for administrative rulemaking and enforcement. It also provides for supervision services, which weren't specified under the last compact. So now there's accountability for those supervision services, and the Interstate Commission, when they do their rules, will come up with the frequency and the content and what it is that we're supposed to be doing. Now we have the option for purchasing services. We've tried in the past to do this where we couldn't get a home study fast enough out of the state of, Ohio. And so we would want to buy a home study from a private agency, but Ohio wouldn't, CPS wouldn't recognize it. They wanted to do their own. And so now we have the opportunity to purchase those services and have to be accepted by those state administrators. Uniform data collection and information sharing. Guidelines involving tribal governments, which is a whole other issue. There's two types of placement evaluations. One is the home study, which we're all used to. The other one is an assessment. The assessment would refer to relatives and could actually provide for a faster placement because we're not asking for the full-blown home study. For an approval, to approve a child's placement, I'm looking at the home study, the background checks, the child protection services background checks. I'm looking at the financial and the medical plan for the support of the child. I'm looking for all this information and all these documents. Well, an assessment would kind of bring that, you know, a little bit, would make that list a little shorter in some ways so that a child could go to grandma without having to wait for that full-blown home study. So we could give a provisional approval. She still has to go through the home study, and everything has to be done, but the placement could happen a lot quicker.
Kind of. Representative Sisna?
And I actually lived through some of this as it applied, in the field, and found out about 4 or 5 years ago after 15 years after the fact, right, went down to the graduation of the foster child who had been placed out of state and discovered, and I don't know how this one works out, but you might have some ideas, that when we sent that child out of state, we did not do a good home study. And I find out long afterwards exactly what happened, and it was pretty horrible, really horrible stuff. And it was us letting go to another state, and then that state started having to pick up the pieces. And those are our kids, right? They're our kids, and they may leave the state, they're still our kids,
right? Madam Chair, Representative Sisna, I got lots of stories too, and some of them are not so good. When those home studies come in, I'm looking at them, I'm reviewing them, but I'm sending it out to the field office, to the caseworker, and I really need their feedback. If that's not enough information for them, they need to tell us. They need to tell me. And I need a list of questions. What other information do you need so we can send it back? If we find we have an insufficient home study, we shouldn't be making a placement. And we should ask for more information first. And then there was illegal placements, which is almost which is called, in our terms, called dumping. We place a child in another state. There's no services. There's no forethought to financial medical plans. Who's going to cover the kid? Who's going to take care of A, B, and C? Where the kid's going to go to school? And that's part of my job as a compact administrator, is to try to make sure before we do this that all the pieces are into place.
Madam Chair, could I do one follow-up?
Yes,
please. Follow-up. Thank you. One of the pieces of this that I just happened to think about was that was a situation where I was trying to stay in touch with the child after the child left for an institutional setting. And I wound up being dropped and tried repeatedly to get back in contact. And fortunately, this child remembered my phone number and kept on calling every year and kind of filling me in, although not as much as I wish. But does this new compact, it sounded like it increases the conversation with the foster parent. Many times a foster parent winds up being the person that kind of sticks with the situation or will.
Madam Chair, Representative Sista, I don't see anything in this compact that follows the relationships that the child has. That, I believe, is a caseworker, parties involved issue, but it's not in there.
Okay.
Just to really quickly go through this, it also specifies the choice of law regarding interstate issues, meaning is it going to be the sending state's law we're going to go by in certain circumstances, or is it going to be the receiving state's laws that we go by?
Oh, I thought they were going to set up the laws so they were the same.
The way we do business is going to be the same, but in private adoptions, it's set up that the choice of law is the receiving state adoption laws are going to take precedence if the adoption is going to happen in that state. If it's going to happen in the sending state, then our laws would. It just specifies that in there so that there isn't a whole lot of debate and the adoption being held up. This compact deletes its applicability to private parent placements with relatives, non-relatives, when the placement will not result in an adoption. So we're not going to be worrying about the private family's choices of where their child is going to live.
Representative Gardner?
There's a concept. Well, first of all, I want to say I'm really glad to see you, because you may not remember me, but I used to be a guardian ad litem, and I did have kids involved with ICPC, and I know your name, and we've had conversations, but mm-hmm. we've never met.
Okay.
There's a concept called, I think it's Indian guardianship.
Indian custodian?
Yes.
Custodianship.
Yes. So, and that is, correct me if I'm wrong, in a Native family, and I believe it's federal law, a person can give a temporary custodian guardianship to their child to somebody else and then just take it back at will. And the idea is to accommodate a parent going to fish camp and leaving a child, you know, with relatives or something like that. Do those apply across state borders, and how does that fit into the ICPC?
That would have to probably be addressed on an individual basis. That's a new one for me. Okay. I've not come across that yet. So I would say no. I would say my understanding of a definition of an Indian
custodian.
Custodian is that they are the parent, that they have the rights and the responsibilities of a parent. They're just called something else. So if they chose to place with Auntie so-and-so, they would be able to do that. Whether that would go fly in Wyoming, I don't know.
Right. Madam Chair, if I'm not mistaken, that's federal law, and the guardian or custodian does have all the rights of the parent. It's simply that it's revocable
mm-hmm.
at will. Yeah. Okay.
We also deleted private parent placements to residential programs. A parent no longer has to go through me to get a placement in Texas for their child. It also changes that the Office of Children's Services and Division of Juvenile Justice no longer have to ask for permission to place a child in a residential program. We have to notify the state the child is going, but we don't have to ask permission for it anymore, which is a big help when you have a child in acute care and they're ready to move on with their treatment and they're having to wait another extra week.
Pat, how much longer do you have? Because
that's actually the only other thing was foreign adoptions are no longer required, and there will be a requirement for a state advisory committee, which will have judiciary, executive, and legislative branch oversight of the way this state does compact business. And that's all I have. Okay. If you have any questions.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And a real quick question. I had in my mind the memory that the No Child Left Behind was trying to be a party on the out-of-state placement of children in treatment centers. And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're getting out of the way of being a go-between.
For private residential placement,
right,
yes.
Exactly, and that's exactly what I mean, because there is a certain percentage of, and it's not small, of the children that are out of state in facilities that are private placements. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the No Child Left Behind was trying to keep to have a role in that so that we had less children outside? Be interested to know.
Madam Chair, Representative Sisto, could you be referring to the Bring the Kids Home project?
Oh, shoot. Pardon me. Oh, man. Pardon me. It's my age.
Right. The Bring the Kids Home is an effort to analyze and do community needs assessments and so on so that we can look at what kind of structures, infrastructure we need in our state so that we can bring these kids home. They can be treated in the communities, if at all possible, so they don't have to go out of state to these other facilities.
So, Madam Chair, how does that fit with this, what you're doing? Is it not a contradiction? Or?
Actually, what they've done now, because I've had some dealings with this just lately, mm-hmm. what they're doing now is before they can go out of state at all, they have to go through some evaluations to make sure they qualify to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not what you were doing. You weren't doing evaluations.
No.
Okay. Just really briefly, could we get a copy of the list that you've just read to us? Because it's very interesting, but I need to kind of reflect on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be wonderful. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that map you had was ICP.
Okay.
That was last year's in the old version.
Thank you.
People have to start all over.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.